needle meter. It has a single cross needle meter. Whether it's on the input or the output, I don't know. I don't have the manual. I don't have a schematic, so I'll have to confirm that tomorrow when I download one. And I'll go from there also. I guess I'll also take out my SWR meter and put it in line and see what I can find. And thank you for all the suggestions and hints, kinks, tips, and heads up on this. I appreciate it. And wonderful, Matt. And thank you, Richard. I don't think anybody was wrong or right about anything. I think all the information was useful, and I actually it just gave me more ideas to how to test and reach different conclusions. So thank you very much. I'm glad I asked the question, and back to you, Richard, and to HUH.
I got a quick comment there, Rich, WY2U.
Professor Mike, WY2U. Professor, straighten us out here. Boy, we are wandering around in the woods. You got it, Mike.
My head was spinning after a little while of that, but okay, thanks to everybody. But, you know, before I interject anything, if I could just ask you, Andy, real quick, how long of a coaxial connection do you have? How long of a run is there between the TS-2000 and the antenna tuner? Is it a couple of feet or is it many feet? Real quick, and then I'll have a comment maybe.
TS-2000 to the tuner is approximately 6 feet.
6 feet may not be enough on 40 meters, and I think that was one of your troublesome bands. I was going to say, I had run into something like this in the past on a friend's installation up north on the North Shore, where he had appreciable antenna currents running on the shield of the coax. Of course, we didn't know it at the time. And as he changed placement between two reading watt meters, exactly the same phenomena, that the power output, reflected power, I should say, and VSWR change with placement. I'm not saying that's going to happen on 40 meters with about 6 feet of lead in. That sounds a little bit too short. But the difference in current, since it uses a Bruin type of coupler, which is the old Collins design, it's a modified Collins design for coupler, it does depend on currents being measured on the equivalent shield of a coax. And if you're measuring the difference between a 3-to-1 VSWR and a 1-to-1 VSWR, let me drop first. Okay, if you're measuring a VSWR difference of, let's say, 3-to-1 to a 1-to-1, that would be a reflected power difference of 25%, the current difference of 18%. I can see 18% current imbalance giving you that kind of a problem. But again, I'm kind of reluctant, Dick, to point out that 6 feet of difference is going to make that much of a current imbalance on a low frequency like 7 megahertz. Perhaps 20 meters and higher, yes, but I'm a little bit suspicious about not offering a possible solution on 40, but I just thought it might be a help, so back to net, WY2U.
Andy's ultimate antenna is a butternut vertical all band, and if he's got a good set of counterpoise rods on it and whatever, hopefully that antenna is not giving him very much coax outer current flowing back down the outside of the cable, which can complicate things. The length of cable is approximately 6 feet between his TS-2000 and his MFJ antenna tuner. Yeah, that's a very small amount of impedance modification. A length of cable, in some cases, can be an impedance inverter. I don't think he's running into that problem. And whether or not he's got the RF in the shack, so to speak, flowing on the coax, there's various ways he can confirm that. And with that particular antenna properly installed after all these years, I kind of doubt that one. So I'm going to agree with you, Mike. It's now beginning to look like there is a definite discrepancy on his input VSWR measurement at the MFJ with its tool, with its cross-needle indicator versus the output of the TS-2000. By way of the Bird Model 43, hopefully he'll get to the bottom of that. Anybody with any further comments on this before we move away from it for tonight? It's a beauty. K2LIW listening. Okay, no, nothing else heard for now. Now, we know we haven't put this one to bed yet, and steady wave ratio is always a hot subject. Joe, W-H-O-L-Y-Y, maybe your subject is not going to be anywhere near as controversial tonight. You've got it, Joe, and we haven't put you to sleep. K-2-L-I-W in the tech net. Okay, maybe Joe got called away. We'll temporarily go over to the next person, Chris. Kilo Delta 2, Lima Victor Golf. If you're still with us, Chris, please go right ahead. K2LAW in the tech net.
Good evening, Net. I don't know how well you guys are going to be able to help me figure this out, but I just picked up a new Yaesu HT. That's what I'm transmitting on tonight. It's the VX8-DR, and I'm having issues with APRS tracking. Assuming I have the radio programmed right, I can never find myself on the APRS.fi map, and I'm kind of clueless as to why. I am picking up stations in the radio, so I don't know.
Okay, from time to time, we do have APRS people on the net. Not always. So if I understand correctly, Chris is telling us that his Yaesu VX8DR, handy talkie, he's trying to use it in the APRS mode, and he doesn't seem to be able to get it operating in the APRS mode, even though it will receive other APRS stations. Before I proceed, Chris.
I'm turning the beaconing on.
Okay, KE2EJ, K2LIW. Go slow, Eric, and tell Chris everything you know on that subject. You've got it, Eric.
All right, if you look in the APRX menu, there's a bunch of them. There's one that's called beacon, beacon on and beacon off. If you've got the beacon turned off, you're never going to transmit. So you've got to have that on, and then it will beacon for whatever period you set it for. It could be every 3 minutes, every minute, every 30 seconds. There's a number of different, some of them have fixed selections of time, some of them you can dial directly in. But without the beaconing on, it's like, it'll never transmit ever.
Chris, you've got somebody who is familiar with this this mode. Ask anything you want. Kilo Delta 2, Lima Victor Golf, K2RW. You got it, Chris. By the way, that smart guy you're listening to is Eric. Go ahead, Chris.
Good evening, Eric. I have it on, and every 30 seconds I see the little red light on VFOB transmit. It sends out the quick little blip, so it's sending it out automatically. It did pick me up once using this HT, but then since then, I haven't been able to find myself again. So my thought is I'm not hitting the repeater based on where I live. Like, could that be an issue? I'm just out of range.
You got it, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
Guys, let me tell you that we used to have more digipeaters on the island. There's not that many of them. So you have to think of it as a device that transmits directly, you know, like you being on 5.2, and that's the sort of range that you're going to be getting from it. Being only 5 watts, it has even less range in terms of being able to get the stuff out. I've got APRS in the car, and most places on the island with 50 watts, it's got no problem hitting any of the digipeaters, but that could be your issue if you're looking for it coming back on another radio somewhere. If you are looking for it coming back on another radio right next to you, then you've got a problem because you're going to be on 3.9. You're going to be listening to 3.9. So you should be able to see the beacon directly from another, either a any kind of packet device that's connected to a computer or any other APRS ready device that actually sees the packets as long as you're going to remember. You're tuned to the same frequency, so you can put one radio right next to the other and you should hear it.
You got it, Chris. KD2, Lima, Victor Golf. Go right ahead, Chris, with any further comments or questions. Maybe Chris got called away, and when he comes back, we'll talk to him again. The next person on the list was John, KC2WGB. And John, you're supposed to have all the answers. Why do you have a question tonight? You got it, John.
KC2WGB. It's tough knowing everything. All right. Have a question on mapping out bird slugs, graphing them out. So let me let it drop and I'll proceed. All right. I have a 100 milliwatt bird slug. Frequency really doesn't matter. And this is what I was doing. I was proceeding through the frequencies that it covers, and I noticed some irregularities. And this is what I did. I want to know if that is a confirmation or did I do something wrong. When I put the generator in the sweep mode, which spans 6 megahertz, we look at, with the proper input to the bird, I had approximately 38 milliwatts on the bird, which is about 15 microvolts. Okay, as it goes through the sweep, I notice a drop of about 2 microvolts at certain points during that sweep. So I wanted to know, was it the dummy load or is it the slug itself that's causing that error? So what I did was I unloaded the dummy load, and sure enough, without any load on there, there was 38 milliwatts on the bird. Okay. Now, it showed the 38 milliwatts, and then I swept it without a load, and it stayed almost perfectly. As soon as I attached that dummy load, I noticed that a microwatt drop on a couple of frequencies. Now, does that test confirm that it is not the bird slug, that it is definitely something in the load itself?
First of all, most of the bird slugs are a directional coupler of, let me pick a number, 20, 30, 40 dB. They're made to measure 10 watts, 100 watts, 500 watts, and so on. So in other words, it's a very gentle directional coupler going into a crystal diode detector that's inside of the slug, and therefore it rectifies the RF voltage that it sees in that direction, presents it to the meter as current, and you read forward and reverse apparent power. The meter is really measuring a 0 to 50 microvolts or something like that. When you go down to the 100 milliwatt slug, we're now a very high percentage of the power going through the bird watt meter is now being selected. In other words, instead of being a 20 and 30 and 40 dB directional coupler, the slug is now a 3 dB or a 6 dB coupler. It's now sampling a much larger percentage of the power that's flowing through. And this has at least two other crazy effects. Let me drop this. Now, if you're doing careful measurements on what's flowing through the bird watt meter with the slug in the forward mode versus the reverse mode, you might see a slight difference in the apparent insertion loss of the bird watt meter. It's now sucking in a much greater percentage of the power. Second of all, the amount of isolation between the slug and the circuit that you're measuring, you're now going to be getting interaction effects. If there's visual, significant visual on that line, you're going to get some crazy effects. So run by one more time, John, what you measured that seemed erroneous to you. I was doing a quick calculation of how many millivolts or microvolts is 38 milliwatts, and I got hung up. So please pass your question by us one more time. It's an interesting question. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, with or without a load on the bird, I had a basic milliwatt reading of 38. But with the slug and the sweep mode of the generator, I noticed it would drop 2 milliwatts. All right. Now, that translates to approximately, at 38 microwatts, the meter is receiving about 15 microvolts. So, and I had that converted to a graphic display through the meter. So, it's going on to a chart recorder. So, what I did was I swept it without the load, and with that full return of reflected power, there was no drop at all. It went through the sweep, and it presented at 38 milliwatts. I only had it vary 2 milliwatts at different frequencies when the load was applied. And I was trying to figure out, is it definitely the load, or could it be a combination, or is it just the bird slug? What do you think, Dick?
Not very clear.
Eric, go ahead and say what you say. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-R-I-W.
Yeah, in your description, John, you said without the load. What are you measuring, and how are you measuring it? Because when I sweep something, I'll take the output of my tracking generator, say, feed that through the device, and then feed that into the detector and the spectrum, you know, the input of the spectrum analyzer to see what's happening. Now, when you say you're connecting the load, does that mean that you've disconnected it from the input of the spectrum analyzer, and you're looking at the reflections of the input? Or it's not clear exactly what procedure you're doing. Because I don't know if you've ever put a dummy load on a VNA and look at it at various different frequencies. You'll find out that they're really not the same unless you have a very precision, you know, a load that's designed to be used over a broad band that is accurate. And even when you spend a lot of money for that, it's not perfect. So, answer the question.
D2WGB. Very good, Eric. Yes, I have no spectrum analyzer hooked up. I'm looking at the meter itself on the bird. I have the generator going to the input of the bird. When the load is on it, and I'm in the 6 megahertz sweep at the frequency it's rated for, I notice some perturbations at particular frequency of 2 microwatts. Okay, I'm reading on an open, without the load on the bird, I have 38 microwatts consistently through the whole sweep. As soon as I attach the load, that's when I notice those that little perturbations at certain frequencies. And I'm trying to determine, is it the load or is it the bird slug itself? So it's only a generator and a bird meter and a load, and it is a very expensive HP load.
Oh, it's still not clear to me how you're making the measurement, because if you hook a load onto the output of the meter, okay, how do you know what's passing through it? Well, do you have a directional coupler before the meter, and that's how you're measuring it?
No, Eric, I'm only using the bird slug, and the reading is coming directly off the bird meter itself. That's where I'm reading the 15 microvolts and the 38 milliwatts.
Yeah, now where does the load come in? Because all right, draw me a picture. You've got a sweep generator that's connected to the meter. On the outside of the meter, where does that go?
Okay, Eric, the generator is going to the input with the left side of the bird, and on the right side of the bird, I have a load that I screw on there. It's a regular 50-ohm load, HP. And that's all I'm doing is putting the load on and removing it.
Well, in other words, one connector of the meter is open when there's no load on it.
That's correct. And that's where I get the full return of that voltage, because it's an open circuit. And that's where I get the same exact voltage, or milliwatts, as I do when I have the bird at the right frequency. And it's reading the same 38 milliwatts. It's only certain part of the span as it's sweeping that I notice that 2 microwatt drop. Milliwatt drop.
Okay, so in other words, you have an open circuit, which you know that 100% of the energy is going to be reflected back in the other direction, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Dick, you being the empirical judge of this, what do you make out of that? Because, I mean, I got trouble with the fact that it's reflecting all its energy and trying to get an accurate reading. The fact that it stays still across the sweep, okay, I'll give you that. So when you hook the load up, it sounds like the load's got little suck-ass in it.
Okay, in the very beginning, I'm a little troubled by the fact that my mathematics says that 38 milliwatts on a 50-ohm load is 1.38 volts on a 50-ohm line is 38 milliwatts. When the bird watt meter is being used into an open circuit, In theory, the forward voltage, correction, forward power and reverse power should be damn close to the same, because that power can't be radiated by that open-circuited output connector, SMA, BNC, type N, UHF, whatever. It ain't going to radiate at normal. Until you get to 10 gauge, you're not going to get any radiation. So if you were pumping 38 milliwatts forward voltage, or forward power, down that cable into an open circuit, damn close to 38 milliwatts is going to come back. Now when you're sweeping it, funny things can happen. A sweeper, let me drop. A well-made sweeper tries to keep its power output, even though it's sweeping through a god-awful number of megahertz of frequency. Many of them have a built-in leveling circuit where they try to keep the forward power coming out of the sweeper signal generator. They try to keep the forward power constant by way of a built-in directional coupler inside of the sweeper with a feedback loop as an automatic gain control circuit, so to speak. Some sweepers do that. And now when that sweeper is itself looking into an almost infinite standing wave ratio, the open circuit on the output of the bird, depending on the whether or not you get really good directivity in that coupler that's trying to do leveling inside the sweeper, you can get some really funny effects. So do you believe your sweeper is being used in the leveling mode, John? That could be one of the contributing factors. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, absolutely. All four generators have the leveling mode. And it's the same with the leveling mode on or off. I can turn on two of the generators, I can defeat the leveling position. But it happens in either way.
Now, the length of cable coming out of the signal generator, going into the bird, and therefore the output of the bird is an open circuit, that length of cable, when it's open circuited, is a kind of resonator. It is a open stub tuner, if you know what I mean. And so it's reflecting power of various phase angles as you sweep in frequency. That's coming back to the leveling circuit. The leveling circuit thinks it's usually looking at something close to a 50-ohm load. In your case, it's looking at an infinity, and therefore that leveling circuit can get kind of confused. So what's the length of cable from sweeper with leveling circuit going into bird, which goes into open circuit? What's that length of cable, John, and the approximate frequency? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That cable is about 2 feet long, and I think the frequency I was working at that time was around 230 meg.
I got something to say. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, let me ask you this question first, John. Have you tried other loads, other resistive loads? Because you're talking at frequencies where things start to get really funny.
Yes, I have, Eric. They were all 50-ohm HP type, and then I had some vine shells. I tried those too, and basically it was only this one slug that was giving me that severe amount, well, I called it severe, amount of perturbation. The other ones were not, and that's why I was trying to chart this load, and I was starting to suspect it.
So what you're saying is that you got the same response from different loads?
No, not the same.
Suggestion for you. Do you have a VNA that operates at 200 megahertz?
Absolutely.
Alright, align your VNA. You know, do your short open and load. And then hook the load up to it and see what it says. Expand the frequency area in which you saw the sun at, and I bet you see something.
Okay, the only issue I have with that is when I pick that 6 megahertz span, you're not going to get a dot in the center of the screen, as you know. it's going to react differently, and it's difficult, even with the expansion, to see those little things that I can see extremely well on the meter. With that, I used a 10-second sweep so that I could watch that needle. So maybe I'll make some changes and go back to the DNA and try that analysis. That might do it. but I just was interested in your opinion and Dick's opinion on whether you think a load can do that and consider it normal.
Well, this is an experiment. It's a try to the merge with DNA. One of the things that I was going to say is that I've experienced a lot of variations, even from the deal with packet companies. I lost what I was going to say. Oh, well. Do that first, you know, so that way all things are being equal. I know what I was going to say is that one thing that you might want to take into consideration, which is something that Dick said before, which is true of the 100 milliwatt plug, is that there's a lower, you know, the coupling is a lot lower, or greater, I would say. And you are putting a 50 ohm resistor on the end of it, and you are actually creating a RLC circuit with the whole thing. So you have to calculate all the limits exactly what frequencies you're dealing with. With the VNA, you can zoom in on any one particular frequency. Don't forget the sweep generator is making only one frequency at a time. So the fact that you have sweeping slowly allows you to see the mechanical meters in. But when you're using a spectrum analyzer, an endoscope, or a VNA, you can zero in on the specific frequencies that are happening and can be able to make measurements.
Very good. Yeah, Eric, that's what I'll do. I'll try to locate the exact frequency range and go into zero span and take a look at it that way and see if it waltzes around the screen. Good recommendation. Back to you, Dick.
If I understand correctly, John, your sweeping signal generator was slowly sweeping. The only instrumentation that was reading any power to you was the 100 milliwatt slug of the bird watt meter. As it swept across the band, you saw these suckouts. And I presume by whatever means you knew where it was, in other words, you know when it's starting in the beginning of the sweep, and it's in the middle of the sweep, and it's the end of the sweep. What was the sweep rate, John? And is the only output indicator the bird watt meter itself, KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Well, because in a 100 milliwatt slug, I was only checking and seeing 2 to 3 milliwatt variation. I was sweeping 6 megahertz at a 10-second, 10-second sweep. So I could look with my Joule's loop at the needle and look at the movement. Then I decided to plug in my chart recorder and expand the input on that. And that's connected directly to the meter, so I could measure the exact voltage I had, the different voltage difference I was looking at. So that's how I had it set up.
Don't forget he said that different loads have different responses.
Yeah, I heard that. And now, the meter that's in the Bird Model 43, was that giving you the vertical deflection on the chart recorder, John? Go ahead.
I was right across the terminals of the meter itself, yes.
So when you told us about millivolts, I thought you were telling us millivolts of the RF energy.
No, I said microvolts.
Okay, the microvolts, I thought that you were talking about RF energy on the 50 ohm line in volts and microvolts. You were talking about the voltage on the Dawson valve movement of the Bird Model 43. Okay. And now you see these suckouts. Out of curiosity, did the suckout that you saw seem to be at the beginning, middle, or end of the band, and the suckout changed when you changed brand name of 50 ohm dummy load? Is that what you said, John? K2RIW?
That's correct, Dick. I was looking at, in a 6 megacycle sweep, I was looking at approximately 3 suckout points that were definite, and they were going down 2 to 3 microvolts, and they were apportioned approximately every third. So that was also strange. And the other expensive loads that I have had some suckout points, but we're talking about like half a microvolt. So it's like nothing. You could just about see it. This here seems a little more severe, and I didn't know if it was a combination of the bird slug and the load, or whether it's always just the load. So, but what Eric is saying, if I do that and find out what those frequencies are and look at it with zero span, I might be able to tell something that way.
The microvolts of dip that you saw is riding on how many overall microvolts? Were you reading 38 microvolts and then seeing 2 microvolts of dip? Is that approximately the numbers, John? Go ahead.
38 microwatts. The meter to get 38 microwatts is approximately 15 microvolts, because it's a full-scale deflection is 30 microvolts, if I remember correctly.
Okay, so 15 microvolts was the average reading, and then you saw 1 or 2 microvolts of dip on the 15, is that what you're saying?
I saw 2 to 3 milliwatts. You have to figure that out, what that would be in microvolts. I didn't bother measuring the exact microvolts. I was interested in why it was just dipping. So I could do that, though.
Okay, once again, I'm trying to find the ratio. 2 or 3 milliwatts of dip on how many milliwatts indicated? Was it 2 or 3 milliwatts of dip on...
On 38.
So 2 or 3 milliwatts of dip on 38 milliwatts. Okay. So now we've got some real percentage here. So we're getting close to a 10% dip. Is that true, John?
Dick, that's what the instruments are telling me.
Okay, 10% dip in decibels is not very much. I think it's half a decibel. So it's not a very big, you're calling it a suck out. It's really a ripple. So you're trying to find out where the ripple is coming from now. And there is a possibility the ripple is coming from an interaction of the diode that's in the bird slug itself. I mean, that diode, normally it is decoupled by a 30 dB coupler because you've got a 50 watt full scale slug. You've got a 100 milliwatt slug, therefore your diode is very closely coupled to that line. And the capacitance of the diode, the nonlinearities, the harmonic generation, that diode is capable of doing some funny things, and that's another contributing factor. The 100 milliwatt slug, I think you'll admit that, John, it is a rather rare slug. Not many people run one that low in power output indication. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, you know, I have to find, I know I have 2 of them, but I could only locate this one. I wanted to compare another 100 milliwatt slug, which I didn't have 100 milliwatts, but I had things close to it. So when I'm measuring those microvolts, I'm measuring actually the output of that slug. And then I was wondering, I'm saying, I wonder if I it's built in with that meter. My chart recorder has extremely high impedance input, so I don't think that's affecting it at all. And it seemed to be the same with or without the chart recorder. So, all right, I'm going to do what Eric recommended, and I'm going to see if I can find those perturbations in on the display itself. That sounds like a good effort, worth a good effort.
So take a look at the enclosure, too. Don't forget that.
Take a look at what?
Take a look at your load on the VNA. And by the way, are you screwing the load right onto the side of the meter, or is it going through another piece of cable?
A direct connection right to the meter.
So I'll make a direct connection to your VNA with that thing and see what the Smith charge shows you.
Very good. Yeah, I'll look it on the Smith chart and the SWR chart and see what ripples show up, if any.
Yeah, some of the variables involved here, John. If you have a second slug of close to 100 milliwatts full scale, does it duplicate? If you have other dummy loads, do they duplicate the suck out, so-called? If you change any cable length anywhere, particularly a cable after the bird into the dummy load, does it have an effect? So cable length, dummy load, and slug itself. By the time you change those 3 variables, you're going to have a lot more data. That may be a little bit confusing, but through all that fog, I think we'll eventually come to a slightly higher conclusion. Does that sound reasonable, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Well, it may not be reasonable, but it's doable, that's for sure. I did try three different cables on the input, but I have no cable on the output because I didn't want to confuse the cable and maybe cause some other complications. Because even adding an adapter connector on there will make a difference, and you can see that on the VNA, or you know, you can see it in the instrumentation that I'm working with. So but all of those are good recommendations.
When you put adapters on the output end of a cable into a dummy load, and you're looking at a voltage network analyzer, VNA, which is capable of looking at reflection coefficients of 50 decibels down, 60 decibels of reflection coefficient, oh, you're going to see all kinds of changes. And because it'll go from minus 60 reflection to minus 50, and a naive person will say, well, that's a 50 decibel change in reflection, and therefore that must be a bad reflector, an adapter. Hell no. A 10 decibel change from minus 60 to minus 50, that's a very minor change. A 10 decibel change from minus 10 to zero, that's a god-awful change. So 10 decibels will change riding on what average number? Minus 60 dB means that you're getting a reflected power a millionth of the power. That's what minus 60 dB is. And you go from minus 60 dB to minus 50 dB, you're going from a millionth of the power to 100,000th of the power. That's still an extremely good adapter. So you can't just look at decibels of change when you're looking at great big negative numbers. The logarithms are kind of crazy in that order. So let me drop. As such, when you think you've got a bad adapter or a bad connector, and you're going from minus 60 to minus 50, that could be an extremely good precision adapter or connector, if you know what I mean. Adding a length of good quality after the bird into the dummy load will give you another variable to play with, and a good piece of cable there shouldn't be doing much, and you can confirm that on your VNA. So by way of the VNA, changing length of cable, changing load, and changing the 100 milliwatt versus 150 milliwatt slug, you know, another slug, you've now got enough variables to play with that are going to give you a lot stronger hints. Did some of this make any sense, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely, Dick. Makes a lot of sense. As you well know, also working with network analyzers, and Eric, you can buy 10 new connectors, top shelf stuff, very nice connectors, and you will see at least 10-15 dB difference in each one as you're sorting through them. And when you're talking about minus 60, minus 70, that changes. Like you said, it's nothing. But and also, the torque wrench on the end connectors going to your VNAs, very important to make sure you torque them up, because you will see that graph change as you bring it to the right position. But you've seen all of that.
I sure have, particularly with an SMA connector. When you use that torque wrench, all kinds of good things happen when you properly torque a good quality SMA connector, as opposed to just finger tightening it. That can make a great, a finger tightened an SMA connector, you might get a minus 30 dB on a good dummy load. You adjust it with the torque wrench, and it jumps to minus 50. And that's a huge difference in quality, even though the actual magnitude of the reflection coefficient in both cases is pretty small. Minus 30 means only a thousandth of the power is coming back. And if it jumps from minus 30 to minus 40, you're going from a thousandth to 1/10,000th, if you know what I mean. Yeah, it's a big change, but it's a big change relative to a very small change, to very small amount of reflection to begin with. What's going on here is a good VNA has ridiculous sensitivity. A properly calibrated VNA with this, what do they call it now, 12-point correction procedure built in with its computer network, with its microprocessor, it can give you some very reliable readings of minus 60 and minus 70 dB, which can allow you to find quality that's almost unobtainable, yet the machine can display it in blazing colors, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Okay, you got some good experiments there, John. And it's going to be educational. You're really probing Mother Nature here. Okay, the next person who signed in was Jonathan, or he calls himself John. KC2, Sierra Hotel Oscar, I think it is. Hope we haven't put you to sleep, John. Are you still there? KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Good evening, Vic, to you. Everyone else in the net? The clock is ticking on, so I'm a little hesitant that we'll have enough. Well, I'm a little concerned we'll have enough time. I think this might be something that's a little deeper, but maybe I'll propose the question and let you decide how to handle it. Does that sound okay?
I'm waiting for the beep. There it is. Jonathan, you're one of our quality people. We're going to make time for you. Go right ahead with your question. You got it, Jonathan.
Okay, checks in the mail. Quite often you've recommended books by John Krause, and quite often I've taken your advice and I've purchased those books. Now, haven't always had the chance to dig into them, and I'm not that I'm not that good with the math to understand some of these things to full extent. But this is something that came up on a local repeater here the other night. Someone was reading the first introduction from the Electromagnetics with Applications 5th Edition book. And I wanted to just read maybe two paragraphs to you here and hopefully maybe hear your words on what this really means. So let me release it and then I'll try to read these two paragraphs here.
Fire away, John. And John's reading from the good book. He's reading right after Deuteronomy. Go ahead, John.
Okay, this came up because to many classic trained technicians and people like myself, this has never been taught to us. So maybe you already know where this is going. So in the introduction, there's a picture here of a simple circuit, a battery, a resistive load, some wires, and what they're calling an infinitely perfect conducting wall. I'm not sure that's so important to the conversation, the last part, but it says, by circuit theory, the battery applies a voltage, sending a current through the wires to the load. Okay, we all know this. This is a simplistic view. The energy is conveyed from the battery to the load almost entirely by electromagnetic fields external to the wires. The wires acting as guides for the energy, as in the figure. Well, you guys can't see it, but you get the picture, I think. An electric field extends between the two wires, and a magnetic field surrounds them. I'm going to release it one more time, then I'm going to read one chapter from the beginning of chapter two here. Or, sorry, one paragraph from the beginning of chapter two. Circuit theory, Circuit theory treats resistors, capacitors, and inductors as two terminal devices connected by wires. Field theory deals with the space both inside and outside these devices, providing a three-dimensional real-world understanding of how they work. As pointed out in the previous paragraph that I read, most of the energy flows outside the conductors of a transmission line rather than inside them, as usually postulated by circuit theory. This is mind-bending to someone by myself. I would love to hear your comments, Dick. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, when we study electromagnetics and circuit theory and whatever in our electrical engineering course in college, we start off with DC circuits. We eventually rapidly progress to HF, VHF, UHF, SHF circuits. The really interesting stuff is microwave, VHF, microwave, and so on. When you get into real RF frequencies, the so-called skin effect on essentially all good conductors, your copper conductor on the center conductor of your coaxial cable, let's assume now it's a single center conductor coax cable, not really seven individual strands, that gets complicated. The skin effect means that the RF energy at reasonable frequencies, I'm talking about 10 megs, 100 megs, 1,000 megs, I'm not talking about 10 hertz. At 10 megs, 100 megs, 1,000 megs, the RF energy is flowing out on the outer 10,000th of an inch of the copper. essentially all the current is on the outer 10,000th of an inch. You could make the center conductor of your coax cable a very thin walled piece of copper tubing, only a couple of thousandths of an inch of wall thickness, and you would have 98% of the performance. The RF energy does not go down inside. How it does that is because of all kinds of crazy external electric and magnetic fields, but for a whole bunch of complicated reasons, the RF energy does not go down into any depth of that center conductor. Do that at 10 hertz, yes, you're using essentially the whole conductor. Do it at 10 or 100 megahertz, you're using the last 10,000th of an inch of the outer conductor. As such, let me drop it. So a simple piece of wire has that crazy characteristic. When you're operating beyond, let me pick a number, 30 megahertz, everything that you think is a lumped element, you've got a RCO7 Allen Bradley carbon resistor in your hand with two axial leads coming out of it, and you think you've got a piece of wire with a resistor, by the time you get to 300 megacycles, that is not a lumped element, it is a distributed element. Almost everything you and I can touch at VHF and UHF frequencies really has some electrical length to it. It is some number of degrees or tens of degrees long in electrical length at that frequency. Therefore, if you take that Allen Bradley resistor mounted in a real good structure and you sweep it across a whole lot of frequencies, by the time you get up to 1 gigahertz and 10 gigahertz, it's not a simple 50-ohm Allen Bradley carbon resistor anymore. It's a resistor with some series inductance and some stray capacitance. It's got all kinds of other characteristics. If you dig deep enough, everything you think is a lumped element is really distributed, and it's not one simple thing. That Allen Bradley carbon resistor, there's a lot more going on there at the microscopic level than resistance. It's got inductance, capacitance, the equivalent circuit of an Allen Bradley 50-ohm resistor measured at 10 gigahertz. It's a fairly complicated circuit. It's more than just a 50-ohm resistor. That's part of what I think Mr. Krause is saying, John. KD2SHO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, and this is a bit of my, obviously yours is much more in depth, but my comment was, oh, it sounds like, you know, they're talking about skin effect. And another gentleman who had brought this up on the local repeater said he didn't think so. He didn't think he was talking about the skin effect here. And so another people had commented in that schooling now is all about this field and studying of the field. So, and even in his example here, he's saying there's a DC battery with a resistive load and claiming that this is even happening with that DC circuit. So I'm a little bit confused just because from what I'm reading on those, at least on those two paragraphs, the math to get into this is a little bit harder for me, but maybe if I sit and study and work at it, I'll figure it out. But it just seemed a bit strange that his example is a DC circuit, and he's using this wording, K2RIW, KC2SHO.
He's using that wording because he's coming from the microwave field. John Krause cut his teeth on microwaves. He lived his whole life in the microwave world. By microwave, I mean microwave by the definition of, let's say, 1960s, yeah, that's when he did an awful lot of his work. Anything above 100 megacycles was considered microwave in those days. Nowadays, anything above 1 or 10 gigahertz. That simple Allen Bradley resistor, if I mounted it at the end of a piece of 50-ohm RG8 cable and put that on a vector network analyzer, at 10 megacycles, it would look very close to 50 ohms resistance. I slide the frequency of that vector network analyzer up to 10 gigahertz, and it's going to have more inductance than resistance. A simple quarter watt or half watt Allen Bradley carbon resistor mounted directly as short of the leads as I can get it, from the center conductor to the shield of a piece of RG8 cable. That's the best way I can mount it on that cable. At 10 gigahertz, I'll measure a hell of a lot of series inductance. However, you take that exact same resistor, you allow me to mount it inside of a coaxial structure where the Allen Bradley resistor is the center conductor. Let me drop it.
AC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. You take that exact same quarter watt Allen Bradley carbon resistor, you allow me to mount it into a coaxial structure where it is the center conductor. The outer shield has got the right side, the right outside diameter versus the inner diameter of the Allen Bradley resistor, so that it looks like a 50 ohm coaxial cable. That's very short. And that outer conductor, I slowly taper it down like a cone to the end of the resistor. The far end of the resistor is going to be grounded by that outer cone. And now you take that structure and you allow me to measure the 50 ohm resistor at 10 gigs. All of a sudden, it's got a hell of a lot more quality. It's the exact same resistor. I've done nothing but change the environment I mounted it in, and I'm going to measure a brand new lack of inductance and a hell of a lot more quality resistance when I do it that way. A number of dummy loads are done that way. They're done as a distributed resistor in a coaxial structure. So what's the inductance of that resistor? Well, it's partially a function of how you measure it. Let's see what Glenn's got to say. KC2QIQ, I bet you've seen some of these distributed characteristics of so-called lumped components. You've got it, Glenn. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And just to add just a little bit more to probably a little bit closer to what Krauss is talking about in that chapter is that one thing that everybody has to understand is when we think of just regular electrical engineering and electrical circuits, we always deal with resistance. We're talking about voltage and current. But one of the other added things is there's a field present as well. So in other words, whenever you think about a current flowing into a wire with just a simple battery, a resistor, and a pair of wires, there's also, if you take your right-hand thumb and use the right-hand rule and you put your thumb in the direction of current flow in the wire, there's a magnetic field around that wire at the same time. So yes, it's true that there are...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, unfortunately, we timed out some of it. But the one missing thing, you aim the current, the thumb in the direction of the current, and you didn't say it, but the fingers are wrapping around the wire, and that's the direction the magnetic field wraps around the wire when current flows. I can take two simple pieces of wire, twist them together with a tight enough twist so that it represents, let me pick a number, a 100-ohm twin lead pair of, a 100-ohm characteristic impedance of a pair of wires. I cut these two wires, tightly twisted together, and the wires are a mile long. You and I know I put an ohmmeter across those two wires, I'm going to measure infinity. You allow me to put an RF pulse down that pair of wires. The RF pulse sees the 100-ohm impedance of the two wires at that particular spacing. It takes roughly 6 microseconds for that signal to get down to the end of the wire where it sees the open circuit, another 6 microseconds to come back. So I'm looking on a time domain reflectometer. Let me drop it. My time domain reflectometer will show a nearly perfect 100 ohms for the first 12 microseconds as that signal flows down. These two twisted wires that are connected to nothing, twisted wires a mile long, for 12 microseconds, I'm going to see a pure 100-ohm resistor. After that, when the signal gets down to the end and bounces back, I'm now going to see it jump up to nearly infinity and open circuit. So what is the resistance of those two wires? What is the impedance of those two wires? It's partially a function of how long they are. I mean, you can take twisted wires, and if you make it an infinite length, it'll be a perfect 100-ohm resistor from DC to light, even though it's connected to nothing. It's just the two wires side by side. You're looking at some of the distributed characteristics of things that have length. You go to a high enough microwave frequency, unless you're working at nanometer-sized components, everything has got distributed inductance, distributed capacitance, and some amount of resistance. That's a little bit about what Glenn and I and John is starting to say, I think. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I mean, everything you're saying is spot on. The only other thing I'd like to add myself is just that, you know, this magnetic field that exists at the same time as the current is flowing. So basically, you know, in a standard circuit, you have V for voltage, I for current, and R for resistance in that very simple circuit. And here again, we also know that there's a magnetic field now flowing around that circuit, or formed around that circuit. Let me let it drop so I don't time out this time. But what's also interesting to note there is that as easily as we can calculate the voltage, current, and resistance in that circuit, there's also that magnetic field can also be calculated. It has units of B, H, and area cross-section. And, of course, there's a path length at which that field flows around. So if you know path length and you know the area cross-section of the magnetic field and you know its magnetic flux and intensity, you can also change all the V, I, and R and calculate it all in terms of just static field. Back to you, Dick. KJRIWKC2QIQ.
One of the things that I think Glenn is touching on here, John, is that if you use some of the modern, really high-quality, expensive modeling programs, like HFSS, for instance, HFSS stands for High Frequency Structured Simulator. I think it sells for like $35,000. You tell me the physical dimensions of that thing that you and I call an Allen Bradley resistor, carbon resistor, for instance, or any other of the components you're about to use. You use the right modeling program, and you put in the physical dimensions of that thing. HFSS will tell you, at this frequency, this is what you're going to see. How much inductance, how much capacitance, how much resistance, what equivalent circuit, and so on. You go to a high enough microwave frequency, nothing is pure. Everything is distributed. Everything's got all these other crazy characteristics. KD2SHO, K2LIW. Go ahead, Jonathan.
VDH, with a comment?
Mr. VDH, go right ahead.
Fine business. Just wanted to mention, he's really speaking of DC. This holds at DC. As a matter of fact, Ohm's law really comes from field theory. It was the integral of E dot dl. You take the electric field and you sum it up over length. That gives you the voltage between those two points. So that really comes from field theory. Go ahead.
Not my microphone. Had trouble finding it. Okay. Let's see if Jonathan is starting to make some sense out of this. Over you, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Yeah, maybe we're just getting hung up on the fact that where he says here, the energy is conveyed from the battery to the load almost entirely by electromagnetic fields external to the wires. So almost makes it sound like, you know, the electron, if it's the right way to say it, the electron transfer function that we were always taught isn't really the truth behind what's going on. Maybe that's where we're getting hung up during this discussion we had here locally. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. When you close the switch on that DC circuit and you connect a real fast oscilloscope to it, that's making all kinds of fancy measurements for you, during the first nanosecond, you'll measure certain impedance characteristics, during the first microsecond, during the first millisecond, and so on. Depending on the physical length of the circuit and how long it takes for the DC current to flow down the length of your circuit, hit the short circuit, open circuit, resistance, capacitance, whatever is downrange, you'll get different amounts of apparent impedance during each nanosecond of time. So even though you think you've got a DC circuit, at the instant you close the switch and you look at that starting transient, which in many real-world situations, that transient is damn important. In the case of the Kettering ignition system we used to have in our automobiles, when those points of your ignition system open up and close. All kinds of fancy physics is going on. There's a lot of places in the world where the transient is a big function of what's happening, and so the so-called DC circuit, if you close the switch and you wait forever and make a measurement, yes, you'll get one.